All right, welcome to another installment of our Professor Profiles. I believe that's still a very tentative name that we're going with. We're just kind of sitting down at this juncture in time and trying to get to know some of our fellow faculty members here in the Department of Communication. I am Nick Messina, specialist professor here in that same department, and along with my my colleague, Matt Harmon, like I said, we're sitting down and trying to get to know the secret life, if you will, of our professors. Try to get to know us a little bit better. And sitting with me today, Assistant Professor of Communication, the Concentration Director of Interactive Digital Media, the Researcher in Residence for Meow Wolf, and the Animator and Director for Elf Powers, All Things Combined Music Video, and all-around snappy dresser, Dickie Cox. How are you today, Dickie?
I'm great, Nick. Thanks so much for taking some time out of your day and inviting me to have this conversation with you.
Oh, no, trust me. It is an honor, a pleasure to sit down with you at all times. It's a regular conversation that we have. However, now it's on mic. So yeah. It's fun stuff. Now, Dickie, you are, as I had mentioned, you're the concentration director for the Interactive Digital Media concentration. Brand new. Here at Monmouth, you do a lot of work with the relationship or investigating the relationship between art, design, communication, society, culture,
and technology.
Oh, I forgot the most important part of it all. What do you bring to the table for yourself? I know you do a lot of like art installations and art work with all of those mediums. I don't even have a Twitter. I don't know how any interactive digital media works at all. Yeah, which is really sad in the grand scheme of things. But so, what's some of the work that you've done previously to bring you to this place?
I purposefully didn't prepare myself today, so this is gonna ramble a little.
That's fine.
Let me say that I've spent almost my entire adult life dabbling. I'm a tinkerer, maybe more than anything. And these days I play, right? What I bring to the table is a sense of experimentation and play with all media and with technology and the integration of both of those things in the service of human behavior, human culture, right? Societal issues. The thing that I'm most interested in is how media is used to build the world that we exist in.
That sounds like a massive undertaking at the end of the day.
Well, I mean, I think that we've, post-convergence, and for those people who maybe don't know what convergence is really something that happened in the early 21st century when digital technologies started to reappropriate former historical analog different forms of media and all entered into that same digital space. So it's this idea that the digital can replicate sound, it can replicate video, it can replicate now objects and scans and meshes of three-dimensional objects, and those data sets that render those previous, it's almost like a carrier wave in audio, right? If we think about radio, there's a carrier wave and there's the signal that is serviced by that carrier wave. Digital really allows us to facilitate the one dimension, words, two dimensions, the audio, the visual, the moving image, three, objects, manifestations of the built environment, four, time.
Oh, God, did that.
And five, behavior, right? Those are the dimensions of interactivity that I see digital servicing. And I get excited because I work across those five dimensions and I try to teach students how those things happen. And oftentimes students get a little confused and they'll be like, well, I don't quite get what this thing is doing. And it's because all of those dimensions are happening simultaneously, and we get to, as media makers, we create those, but just as consumers of media, we learn to parse those things and analyze them and be critical and see how they're made. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's, you know, media is servicing some form of persuasion, typically.
It sounds like you're playing, like, you know, one of those five-tiered, like, chess games the entire time, trying to put together a project at any one point. It sounds almost overwhelming to even, you know, begin to... You're right. You know, we parse out all of these individual aspects and try to analyze them individually, and sometimes have a lot of challenge just doing that. All five all together. What a monumental undertaking.
We've been practicing with those five dimensions our whole lives in many ways. Like, you know, maybe I'm thinking about it a lot more these days because, you know, I have a new son. But watching reflexes develop, you know, understanding how mediation works through the process of developing a nervous system and the cognitive processes coming online. Like, I mean, many of these things are reflexive to us now. We don't have to think about them. We can often act in an autopilot mode. And I think as consumers of media, we are very nuanced. We are very savvy. But I think one of the reasons I appreciate being in a comm department right now, even though, you know, I sort of see myself more as an artist and a designer.
Yeah.
Is the amount of attention that we pay to being critical and breaking those messages and the delivery vessels of those messages apart in an analytical way.
It's interesting because this, you know, it circles back to that idea of convergence that you had mentioned, and talking about that with people, some of these previously assumed barriers that exist or existed no longer do at all, you know, from a psychological perspective. You know, the idea of geography as a barrier no longer exists as a result of this digitization and things along those lines.
Well, and in that thread, I mean, the whole idea of democracy and the democratization of media sort of shifts. You know, a lot of the gatekeeping used to happen because media technology was very expensive. It had to be housed in unique locations. And so that was gatekept by points of distribution. But it was also gatekept as, you know, you had to have a studio to do it. And now how many young people do I know who have studios at home, or even the idea of a studio on a mobile device now?
Oh my God. Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
As a teacher, it's fascinating to see those same paradigms being applied to education and students who understand that democratization of media, sort of applying that to their expectations of education.
It is. It's a fascinating thought process. You focus a lot on, which I love also, you know, I did a little research, which is always, you know, important to which is always important to highlight. Much of your work is surrounded or does surround toys and gamification.
I like to call it play.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Was there a particular moment when, again, throughout your studies or even beforehand, where all of these individual factors start to click? Was there any one particular interaction that you were having with while at play where you kind of realized, like, This is a field of study, and this warrants investigation, and, you know, this is a good thing for myself and for others to know about as well.
So there's not one moment per se, but there are a lot of moments that I could string together, and if you'll allow me, I will.
We've got all the time. We are recording digitally, so there is no end of tape that we will click by any means.
So I think early on, some my earliest memories as a kid was I loved staring at toys. I loved examining toys. And I mean, I liked, you know, the earliest toys for me. It's interesting knowing as an adult that Star Wars is this transmedia and maybe one of the first transmedia platforms at the scale at which it developed. So Star Wars had an immense impact on my, you know, I was two when the first movie came out.
Yeah.
So my earliest ideas of narrative and mythos are carved around that form of transmedia entertainment, and the toy line that came out of that to retell the story, right? And that mediation of the toy to tell the story, or, you know, for the organization of, you know, Lucasfilms and George Lucas making 2% off of all those toys that were sold, you know. So like, as an adult, I can examine all of that, but at the root, as a kid, I was telling myself stories, and I was retelling myself certain stories. So there was a mythology that was in my mind. I grew up in a really small town in Southern Virginia. One of the stories that I often tell is that at the age of 13, Dungeons and Dragons really saved my life.
Oh yes, you now are you still an active?
Yeah,
dungeon.
So I still D&D player. I love playing games. Oftentimes I'll say I play games, and people just make an assumption that I play video games, and that's what I'm talking about. And I do love video games. Don't get me wrong. It's a huge industry that is now on par with the scale of the film industry. So it can't be ignored as a cultural phenomena. And so I think it is ripe as a place to examine. But my real interest is in a subset of that gaming industry, which is tabletop gaming. I love board games. I love role-playing games. I like being at a table with people. And I'm not a particularly competitive person with games. I really just like examining systems. I like thinking about rules. I like watching how other people play, right?
You're more attracted to the strategic aspect of the game rather than the I need to beat the person sitting across from me or you know, I need to beat myself.
Well, it's like it's a place to experiment, right? And to me, like, that act of play, to go back to something we were talking about earlier, the act of play is about experimenting. It is it's creating a meta experience to try something that is not your first impulse. And the way I bring play into education is really that idea that, you know, I increasingly see students coming to that first solution. And it may be a fine solution, but the thing that I've learned is if you examine a little more, if you dig a little deeper, if you try to connect more dots, you'll often come up with an alternative solution. And to me, play and experimentation is at the heart of being human. It's about digging.
One of the reasons why, you know, Toys R Us a little while ago had left, you know, they tried to draw the line that, you know, so many more younger people and younger children were getting more and more of their entertainment through, or not of their entertainment, but their games and their entertainment through iPads and you know, some of these more digital systems. Do you think that, so even without the data, we can probably say that tangible toys, tangible objects with which to play, have probably declined, the production, the purchase of them and utilization of them and the playing with them. Do you think that that's going to have an impact on imagination maybe going forward? Or do you think that as a result of being able to create a space and a world with this new technology, that in fact the opposite will happen? We'll have an expanded idea of imagination.
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought about it framed like that. So a couple of just like gut responses. Late 90s throughout the 80s into the 90s, there was a ramping down of manufacturing culture, manufacturing production, especially in the U.S., while it was proliferating globally. So there were a number of economic types who were looking at that, you know, what comes after the consumerism that is fueled by manufacturing. And I mean, it's hard to say that we've come to an end of that if you consider how much money Amazon makes and the way the gatekeeping changes across those economic systems. But there's this idea of the experience economy, and it is not wasted on me that it coincided with the advent of the internet as a massive public platform. And this idea of the experience economy is the economy that follows it. You know, it's not a service-based economy. It's a kind of service economy, but it you know, it's kind of tourism. And I think for my interest in Meow Wolf and the kind of work that they do, and then the bigger picture of the immersive art and entertainment communities and makers, this idea of the experience economy is literally world building, right? It is, and I think it benefits from that post-digital turn, right? The post-convergence. It's this idea that we can literally build worlds using these digital tools. And so being around those hundreds of people who are working in the Meow Wolf factory, it's really hard to believe that these tools and these digital experiences are going to somehow have less of an impact on the imagination. And I would say, you know, I have an 8-month-old right now, and I haven't told him anything about screens per se. I haven't described media to him, but I can tell you that every time a phone enters the space that he's in, or anytime a laptop is open in the space that he's in, or if we're in a retail space that has giant TVs, his attention goes to those screens. It's a natural phenomenon. I've not told him anything about them, right? He's uncovering the world for himself. So there seems to be this attraction to that emanation of light. Not to be too metaphysical, but
no, please.
That emanation of light, you know, he still has plenty of tactile experiences. His sensory experiences are still very present. And I think part of the reason that these immersive experiences that are unfolding are, you know, they start as ideas in one nervous system. Multiple nervous systems share those ideas. They manifest them. They ideate. They start to build with these digital tools. They build with analog tools. They build objects. They build spaces. They build narratives that fit in those spaces. There's a fabrication of other worlds literally happening. You know, it's pretty out there if you slow down and start to unpack it.
It is, but, you know, it calls back to that fifth dimension or fifth aspect that you're talking about in terms of, you know, behavior and
human behavior.
Yeah, human behavior, which is a...
Well, and it's something we've been doing for a long time. I mean, so, you know, as an undergraduate, I studied with an Andean ordained shaman whose father had made significant academic work around the remnant tribes of the Chimu in Peru.
Oh my God.
And so he did this really interesting sort of cross-sectional study of time in this one geographic region. And that's always sort of stuck with me. And he used this idea of like the laws of dissipative structures.
Which is, yes, for...
It's
for
thermodynamics, right?
Okay.
Cannot be created nor destroyed. So again, it gets a little metaphysical.
Perfectly fine. I obviously just wanted you to explain for whoever's listening. I clearly, I've been following the whole time.
So humans, so he started with the you know, this cross-section of time went back, you know, 100,000 years. Pre-language, right?
Yeah.
So that entity, the entities that we were evolutionarily, and then the thing that we became, and the advent of language across, you know, the different genuses, were part of this examination, right? So what is that impulse to language? Like what... And I remember in class we talked about what is this idea, like what is the first thing that we needed to say to one another? And at the end of the class conversation, the thing that we arrived at was, hey, do you see what I'm seeing?
Huh.
Right?
Oh, man.
It's like, we develop language to have a confirmation of experience.
Right. Oh, Dickie, now I'm having like an existential crisis of my own trying to, because I'm thinking, I was like, well, I don't know, is it help or... But no, it was. Look at this. Come here and see what I'm seeing.
But it's amazing that, you know, that confirmation leads to our ability to begin to organize.
Well, and I'm sure empathize at the same time then.
Empathize, yeah, to express I mean, all of the things that we do routinely with language or with any of our manifestations of language, which are mediated experiences, like there's a lot to do with like emotional confirmation or wish fulfillment or just telling stories.
And it's a beautiful thing. And I guess that's some of the work that you do with Meow Wolf. I was trying to figure out a way to describe what Meow Wolf is, what that space, you know, kind of is. And, you know, I was only able to really come up with like adult playground.
That's a reasonable take on it. So let me say first that I research Meow Wolf. So it's not that I work with Meow Wolf.
Oh, okay.
And I got incredibly lucky to know a couple of people within the organization. And, you know, because of the power of the internet, I was giving an artist talk just before they opened their first permanent installation in 2016. And I gave a shout out to them opening. The CEO at the time reached out to me and, you know, thanks. Someday I hope we get to work together on something. And I sure did too, because like, you know, to go back to that question you asked earlier of like those moments that like affected what I wanted to do, you know, so it was examining toys as a kid. It was Dungeons and Dragons. And in 2011, I saw Meow Wolf's work for the first time in a contemporary gallery space. It was this trans-dimensional 75-foot multi-story pirate ship that literally had different parts of the ship had its own personality. You could tell that it was lived in and occupied. And I came to discover that hundreds of people had helped build and fabricate this thing. And they had done it as an art collective that started as a core of a dozen people and counted on volunteers doing what they call, I've now discovered, they call reverse capital, right? They all worked part-time jobs so they could spend all of their money building these things that would pop up for a handful of months, maybe at a time, or even weekends or weeks, and then they would just take them down and demolish them, right? This act of like building and taking down. And they realized that in order to keep doing it and to build at the scale they were working at, they had to manifest their first permanent space. And so, you know, now to go back to the story of like that first shout out from Vince when I gave, you know, this artist talk in Vermont, he reached out to me and said, you know, someday love to collaborate on something. And I said, me too, because honestly, that pirate ship in 2011 was life altering. You know, at that point I had made media. I had experimented with lots of kinds of media. I'd done zines. I was a filmmaker. I was an animator. I'd mostly done screen-based work or sound time-based work, right? Mm-hmm. Like 2D and 4D. I'd never made objects. I'd never thought about that. And I step into this space that is this fabricated scenic design, but it's not just a proscenium. It's not just a surface. It's like the way Katie Kennedy, who is one of the founders of Meow Wolf, described it, and she's currently a senior creative for, you know, a company of now 450 people in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She was like, imagine the weirdest sci-fi movie that you've ever watched is a place that you can go to. And you can examine the locations within that set, characters, weird, strange, interactive phenomena, to the highest and finest level of detail that you possibly can. All the way down to like, you can get down on the floor and like peer into a tiny crack in a wall and you can see something on the other side of the wall, right? It's like that level of detail that hundreds of people have built around these sort of weird stories and ideas that are loosely connected. There's a loose narrative that threads 20,000 square feet of space together. And it's a phenomena that attracts over 1,000 people a day.
Oh, I'm sure. Because I was just, the thought that I had in that is we can all go to this space and yet each one of us come out with a different experience.
There are no maps. There are no guided tours.
And I think that's phenomenal, you know, especially, you know, living in the sort of day and age that we do, where while we are given the opportunity to reach out and experience more and explore more than we ever could, we seem to be picking paths and sticking with one path and not necessarily being given the opportunity to deviate and to explore for one reason or another. And it sounds like this is basically saying, like, no. You can and you should still be searching and looking. And yeah, we can be surrounded with one another, but each one of our own experiences is going to dictate this experience, which will then, again, still be different from everybody else's.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's very much like an open-designed video game, right? It's like a video game in real life. And I can tell you that I've been there a dozen times for as short as maybe 3 hours one visit and 12 hours another visit.
Oh,
maybe
man.
Not quite 12, maybe like 9. But long day, right?
Yeah.
And having gone there for hundreds of hours, I can tell you that I found something new every single time I went. There were literally spaces that I had not been to until, you know, the 10th visit, the 11th visit.
That's so exciting. That is incredibly, exciting. I don't think we have that a lot of times. You know, sometimes if you go to a museum and you go to a space, I've seen it all already. You know, I've done this. And it becomes mundane and we lose that interest. But to know that there are all these little, you know, maybe Easter eggs all over the place, that forces you to look further or look beyond what you're seeing. It's an exciting and it's a new endeavor. It basically says it's okay to be curious.
Absolutely. And it encourages play and having a playful eye, right? So one of the stories I often tell is that, you know, from about the age of 5, I've been looking for a doorway to Narnia everywhere I go, right? And maybe I do it a little less now. But in 2011, I found that door for the first time when I stepped into a Meowwolf installation. And what's amazing is, like, there are tons of groups now that are doing this kind of work. They're building these fictional worlds. But I think the promise in something like this is that these collectives are literally manifesting into the real world, right? So there's this opportunity, you know, people often talk about this work as sort of escapism. So I guess the question that I have sort of as a philosophical poet, right, is like, what is it that we're escaping from?
Yeah.
And how can, you know, the work that these collectives are doing, how can we take those skill sets, take that sense of collaboration and working together, and how can we take that wonder of those fictional worlds and make that the world that we're escaping from? How can we, you know, so maybe it's a little utopian, but
I don't know. I don't think that I can't imagine meeting anybody that would try to make an argument that that's a bad thing.
Well,
so within reason, but or at least striving
To
that.
I'm sure if we open the comment section, someone would come up with some ideas there.
Luckily, this is just for listening. There is no interactive element here by any means. So sorry to all of you listening. You just have to yell at your screen or out into the ether.
You know, a lot of this is I'm processing a lot of our conversation right now, and you know, the phones that are in our pockets right now have fundamentally altered our society for the good and for the ill. And you know, there is a democratization, there's this direct democratization, and you know, it's also, it's grown very quickly. It's gone unchecked, in terms of, you know, how it's regulated, and the level of experimentation by companies on humans. Like it is literally like kind of a human experiment, right? I think if you really take a minute to think about, you know, you put an address in and you literally go where a company tells you to go.
Yeah.
Is freaky.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't usually frame it that way. They're just like, oh yeah, Google Maps got me here.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So this post-mobile turn is, we're in a weird place because in terms of the one-on-one behaviors that I see in space, like, we're often connected to those people to the exclusion of the people that we're in an immediate space with. And we use these devices as kinds of shields and deflectors so that we don't have to engage in things that we, you know, see as uncomfortable. Sherry Turkle, who's at the MIT Media Lab, talks a lot about how, you know, digital allows us to create these sort of like perfect scenarios and we can edit and cultivate. But like being around people in meat space and in real time, like, can't edit that. And I mean, certainly I can think of all the times I've stayed awake in the middle of the night, like, why did I say that?
Yeah.
I think these kinds of spaces offer this alternative to us to practice some of that discomfort or awkwardness in spaces that don't have the normal governing rules of reality or society. They're weird spaces, and we can be awkward together in these weird spaces as a way of practicing being public and being social together.
I feel like you just described my classroom usually. That's so in a word, how do you, in a word, you know, what is your feeling going forward on human technology interaction and homogenization, for lack of a better term?
I mean, we're all functional cyborgs as far as I can tell already. Well, not all, but a significant population on this planet. And connectivity-wise, we have over 7 billion humans, and it's like 56% of the planet is connected. Less than half of those people have broadband access, so that's a game changer too. But there's this sort of increased hive mind that we're connected to as a planet. But I think about that 44% that is not connected.
Yeah.
I think about the exploitation, right? So I think there are some big things that we have to solve, both culturally and globally. A lot of those are governed by economics that go unexamined, mm-hmm. and industries that go unexamined. So, you know, I guess I'm a Marxist. Like, it's about the forms and control of the means of production, and the who benefits from the means of production. So I think there are big questions that have to be examined. I don't know that any one of us can answer them, but they need to be examined much more thoroughly. I think our politics have to change a lot. We need people who are able to unpack at the speed that these developments are occurring so that we have real regulation that's meaningful. I think psychiatrists are going to have a field day for decades.
Right? Oh, goodness. God knows mine does.
I don't know if I can put it in a word to answer your question. There, to me, there's just so many unknowns. I think a lot of these technologies take away from our ability to remember that we're an embodied organism, right? That we are having a conscious experience that is like being driven by neurochemistry. So we're just operating on all of these layers constantly. My hope is that, we can be uncomfortable thinking about, oh, I am a neurobiological chemical process that's occurring that is like having a socially awkward moment with another collective neurological entity, right? Like, and that somehow creates meaning, spirituality, connection.
When it's all lumped together, these will never be separated again. This technology and what it means to be a human will essentially...
Well, it depends on how we define what a technology is. And, we can think about digital technologies and electronics as technology, but that's not the sole technology out there.
True. You know?
The fact that I can still swing a hammer is still...
A tool.
It's still a tool, and those tools are our technologies. And they're ever-changing. But ever since we had that instinct to, you know, swing a stick or throw a rock or put the rock on top of the stick and bind it together with a vine to make it more of a a leveraging capability to extend our natural ability to do something supernatural.
Wow. That is a lot to unpack. Wow. You know what? And I've been doing this with everybody just when we wrap up, because we've been having these genuine conversations. I've got to say, this has been an experience for me thus far that's been so much fun, because I get to see a lot of, you know, I get to see everybody on a regular basis. But getting to sit down in this environment and really chat about not even so much what we're doing, but those things that we think about that impact what we're doing, and hopefully, you know, bringing more of a look into our backgrounds and things along those lines has been great. So I've been trying to at least, you know, wrap up on a similar thread.
Okay.
A little light. What are we watching? What are we reading? What are we listening to at this particular moment in time? Sometimes the easiest questions are the ones that always throw us for a loop the most.
I'm having some weird guilty pleasures right now. So I haven't been able to undertake a lot of ongoing and dedicated reading and viewing just because of having an infant in the house. I've been watching a lot of YouTube and Twitch gameplay videos and people who are using gameplay videos as like narrative building. So I've been spending a lot of time looking at that. Reading, I've been doing a lot of research. So part of the work that I did with Meow Wolf is this ethnography of the Meow Wolf structure, and thinking about post-capital models. And so this idea of post-capital is like what's going to replace capitalism, because many people suggest we're in late stage capitalism.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm looking at this idea of collectives and how collectives can control the means to ideas and to the manifestations of ideas through production. So, you know, I'm reading a lot of like academic articles in support of, you know, trying to write my own essays right now. None are coming off to the top of my head immediately, which is the nature sometimes of academic writing, is it's,
you know, it all blurs together.
We search for articles. You know, so I'm looking at a lot of these ideas regarding the economics, inclusive economics, and reading articles around what does an inclusive economy look like.
I would love to be a part of that inclusive economy. Very, very much so. Dickie Cox, I cannot thank you enough for sitting down with us. Dickie Cox, assistant professor here in the Communication Department of Communication, concentration director of IDM, and I'll still reiterate it. A damn snappy dresser.
Thanks so much.
Folks, thank you very much for joining us. Make sure you keep an eye out for our next installment, or you can go ahead and just click right over to the next person now. I'm Nick Messina, specialist professor of communication here at Monmouth University, and we'll see you again later.